Hi, folks. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Jamie and I use he, him pronouns. You're listening to the Proper Full On Gay Podcast, the show where we talk about Heartstopper with leading queer youth charities and other really interesting guests from around the world. Tonight is another extra special episode, not just because it's when Tao and Elle kiss for the first time, but because I've got two amazing guests for you to meet. First up is Tim Wildboar from Tandem Counselling, and we also welcome back Leo Vardy from the Rainbow Project. Hello!
Hello!
Hi there, how you doing?
So good. Are you both excited to be on the show?
Can't even contain myself. Jumping up and down in my seat right now.
Oh, that's so good. Tim, this is your first time with us. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about Tandem?
Hey listeners, I'm Tim from Tandem Counselling. My pronouns are he, him. I'm the founder of Tandem Counselling and I'm a pluralistic counsellor, which means I'm trained in many different types of therapy with the ability to flex my style to meet the client where they need a counsellor to be. I'm so excited to be here and start the show today. Thank you so much for having me, Jamie.
Oh, it's so good to have you with us. What was it that attracted you to a career as a counsellor, Tim?
I think after working in a role and in an industry for years, I worked in garden centres previously, but nothing against garden centres, but for myself.
It's a bit different.
Very different. And after years of working in garden centres and working my way up, I just felt like I wanted to do something where I was helping people. Yeah. It's that old cliche reason, but it is an honest reason.
Yeah.
So after working my way up to management and I was loving what I was doing, one of my old colleagues literally came to me and said, oh, so do you want to be an area manager? Because I was a manager. And I was like, God, no. Do you want to be a site manager? God, no. Oh, so you've peaked. Jamie, I was 21. I was like, this cannot be the peak of my life.
Oh, that's depressing.
Yeah, I loved it, but I was like, I want to do something different. I never planned to get into garden centers. I just fell into it.
Yeah.
So
very
the next
good.
Month, I signed up for counseling.
Yeah, and the rest is history. That's great. Yeah. That's great. Well, it's so good to have you on the show, Tim. It really is. We got some really meaty story arcs coming up, so to have your voice is great. You know, it is. So thank you very much. Hello, Leo. Welcome back. This is your second time with us.
Yeah, and as I was saying to you earlier, I've gone bald between the seasons of Proper Full On Podcast, but I'm loving it and I'm living it.
You've embraced
it. I look great and I feel great. And for people who weren't here last time, my name is Leo Lardy. My pronouns are he, him, his. I am the Sexual Health Development Officer at the Rainbow Project. The Rainbow Project basically looks after the health and well-being of LGBTQI plus people across Northern Ireland, whether it's like counselling, rapid HIV and syphilis testing, or, you know, meetup groups where we all just have the crack and have a gas together, you know?
Yeah, we might have some listeners to think that you mean something else whenever you say have a crack.
Have a good time. Have a very reasonable good time with absolutely no ill repute whatsoever.
That's what they all say, Leo. That's what they all say.
We'll see how the podcast goes, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. What did you folks think of this episode?
I thought it was excellent. It was a bit... It was kind of hot and cold because there were so many lovely things happening. And then to have it zoom in on some of the more difficult aspects of like Nick's and Charlie's life was kind of a little bit heart sore. Like it was really sweet to see Elle and Tao get together. But yeah, just I wanted to run into the screen and give them both a big hug.
Oh, I know. I feel teary just thinking about it. My goodness, it is hard whenever we start to get beneath the surface of some of the story arcs that are coming up, you know, and this is it being introduced almost formally for the first time. Like they've hinted around Charlie's disordered eating quite a lot in the past, but I think in this episode and the last episode, they really do start to hone in on it.
I thoroughly enjoyed the episode. I think it was really interesting to kind of get that insight into Charlie's eating disorder because as we said previously, it was kind of hinted at throughout, but it's the first time where it's really kind of leaned into and you really get to see the kind of effects from something like that. And I think one of the highlights for me, and I know we'll talk about it later on, is finally kind of addressing that will they, won't they between Tao and Elle.
Oh, like I know.
It's been It's been building for two seasons. Come on, let's get to it. And it's so nice to finally see that kind of flourish.
Definitely. There was so much angst. They built far too much angst into the first three episodes. If you've listened to the show, you'll know how I feel about the whole date scene at the cinema and everything else. And so it was lovely to finally get to that moment where they connect romantically. You know, it was really, really nice. Anyway, before we go on, we should do a content warning. So in today's show, we're going to touch on things like disordered eating and potentially self-harm. I think they're the only two things that come up that are really that we should maybe forewarn listeners about. And by the way, this is a Heartstopper show that absolutely embraces spoilers. So if you haven't read ahead in the books, then we suggest you do that. Get yourselves the books. They're so good. Before we get stuck into the episode, I need to do like a corrections corner, because last week's episode, or the last episode we recorded, I alleged that part of Nick's script was incorrect, where he said the first time they kissed was at Charlie's house, but he was saying the first time they kissed at Charlie's house. So does that make sense? So yeah, so many listeners got in touch to correct me. I'm so lucky to have such passionate listeners who aren't scared to reach out. And I say that with a huge heart. I'm not saying that sarcastically. I really love to hear from listeners. Do get in touch and share your views. Thanks so much for everybody that's reached out. We've had loads of listeners reach out and tell our stories and stuff. Really, really heartwarming. It's lovely. Should we get stuck into the episode?
Let's do it.
Heck yeah.
So the show opens with Nick checking his phone. His dad hasn't been responding to his messages. It's just a wee bit heartbreaking.
What age is Nick actually in the show?
16.
16. And that is so much to be dealing with as a 16-year-old. Like, as a young person, for your parent not to even respond to your messages when you're in the same country as them, when clearly they don't get a lot of time together, it's like he's gone across the pond to see him. He's made all this effort and he's barely 30 minutes away and he still can't figure it out to go see his son. It's just there's so much going on for poor Nick, like between having to come out and stuff with his brother and then his dad. I want something to go right for him.
Because he's visiting like his dad's city. It must be so exciting. Like it's not like his dad's down the road and he's trying so hard to connect with him. And it's just really painful to watch.
You'd like to think that his dad would make the effort, because as we were just saying, like Nick has made all that effort to go all that way to Paris to spend some time with his dad. He's been reaching out, he's been texting, trying to ring. You'd like to think that his dad would, you know, reciprocate and meet him halfway at the very least. And by halfway, I mean 30 minutes down the road.
Yeah, like his dad should be like, if that was me, I would be so excited that my kid is coming to town. You know what I mean? And it's hard to understand how he isn't excited and how he doesn't seem very engaged. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, Charlie messages Nick, calling him into the bathroom, where he shows him the love bite. Scandalous. Let's listen to their conversation.
Oh my God. Is that... Did I do that?
Do you think anyone will notice?
Yeah, I think everyone will notice.
Yeah. But no one will notice you.
I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to. I don't even know how to do that, to be honest.
It's fine. I really enjoyed it. A lot.
What are you two doing in there?
How did you get that bruise on your neck?
Oh my God. You! I cannot believe it! The actual... We will be having words.
So awkward. I love Charlie's optimism, asking if anyone's going to notice. Like, hello? Of course they're going to notice.
It's just hilarious because I think back to being that age and I remember like actually doing like hickeys, we call them over here at Love Bites, same sort of thing. But I remember actually doing that onto somebody accidentally and then being like, oh God, now what do we do? So I think it just perfectly captures that kind of young experience, or at least an experience I had when I was about that age.
I mean, to share myself on a podcast, I recently had a very visible hickey as a 33-year-old man. So let me tell you, when I felt watching this Heartstopper episode, I was like, what am I doing? Funny. What kind of life am I leading? That I have the same problems as a 16-year-old. It's just the idea of someone saying, like, how did you hurt your neck? I'm like, these young boys are so innocent. Because if they were going to a school in Belfast, immediately, like, ye dirty, you know?
Yeah.
How did the optimism, I mean, can you even call it optimism? That is just pure ignorance there, that everyone will not know what that is and where it came from.
It's hilarious. It's so funny. And then Tao is so angry. He's so angry with Nick for doing it, you know?
I think I really love Tao, and I feel like he certainly gets enough screen time, but I think that there's a lot of stuff about Tao's character that isn't just shown on screen or even in the books. It's kind of implied. Yeah. And I am always thinking about how he must constantly be thinking, how can I protect Charlie from bullying? And even though he's kind of doing this and like, oh, you silly boys, what have you done? Like, I think there is a genuine part of them that's like, you've put my boy in harm's way again.
Definitely. And I think we get a bit of insight into why that is later on in the episode, whenever he has that heart-to-heart with Charlie on the bridge. But it's super sweet in a way.
Poor Ty just loves so hard.
I know, that's it. What was it that Nick said I think it was at the end of the last episode. Is it that he loves very loudly, or he cares very loudly? And that's exactly, it summed it up so well, you know, it's exactly what Tao does. It inevitably does get very awkward for Charlie when the other students start to notice his hickey, especially Harry at breakfast, who points it out with great pleasure. With Ben centered again behind Nick and Charlie, out of focus as they sit and have breakfast, let's take a listen to that conversation. Nobody
really cares. I blame Nick entirely.
That's fair.
It wasn't just his fault. I was also involved.
Oh, no need for the gory details.
Oi, Charlie Spring, who gave you that hickey?
What? Well, that's not ideal.
Not hungry?
Not really.
Okay, well, I'll pack you a croissant.
So if you get hungry later, you'll have a snack.
You're the best.
Something to be proud about, isn't it?
Getting some action.
Wait, is it true James McEwen gave you that hickey?
What? He's the only other gay guy on the trip, so...
Did you see that guy down in the reception? Dark hair. I think he gave Charlie his hickey. No, it's just a
weird guy. Leave him alone. It's none of your business.
It wasn't me. I mean, obviously you know it wasn't me.
So much is packed into this little tiny, we've got two scenes there, the breakfast scene and then them as they board the coach, the students as they board the coach. There's so much packed in there. First of all, Nick is still paying attention to Charlie. He's picking up that Charlie doesn't eat very much. He makes a comment about it at breakfast time and packs up a croissant for him to eat later on, which is really sweet in a way. And then we also get reminded as they board the coach of society's ingrained biphobia. Someone asking if it was James that gave Charlie the love bite. After all, he's the only gay guy on the trip. It's like bisexual people don't exist at all.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunately quite a common experience. I'm bisexual myself, and the amount of times that I'm engaged to a man and the amount of people who instantly assume, oh, you're gay then because you're engaged. And just all the time that bi erasure happens so often. And you're right, I hadn't even clicked that that was happening in that scene until you've just said it. But yeah, everybody jumped straight to, well, it's got to be the other gay lad because that's the only other gay lad in the entire school.
Yeah, for sure. And it puts James in this really awkward position because he's trying to be all flirty with Isaac and he doesn't want Isaac to think that that was him that gave Charlie the love bite. You know what I mean?
Bless him. Yeah, and I think... whenever I watched that scene and saw Nick wrapping up the croissant, I was I thought, like, obviously I've read the book, so I kind of knew that Charlie had issues with disordered eating. But I did think on watching the first season again that it was kind of weaved in there more than I'd realized the first time. Like, it Charlie basically is. Never eats on the show. And I had wondered at what point somebody else would notice, you know?
Yeah, and he's absent a lot at mealtimes, especially towards the end of season one. And then other characters start to call it out. Like, they'll be having lunch and they'll be like, where's Charlie? You know, they start to question, where's Charlie? They don't make the connection with mealtimes, but they're deliberately, it's called out in the script. So you're right, totally.
I think it's so cleverly done in season one because it is so subtle. And when you're not looking for it, it does go undetected. But I've also read the comics. So once I'd read them and rewatched it, because I watched it before reading, I instantly started to see it and I was like, oh, it's there. Oh, it's there. He's also missing that. Oh, we didn't eat that. Everybody else had eaten. And you do start to pick it up. And I love the way they kind of intertwine that throughout from literally the first episode.
That's it. And in a way, being on this school trip makes it a little bit harder for Charlie to conceal that he isn't eating. Like, as a teenager who is out with their friends and then home with their families and then spending time with other friends, it becomes quite easy to conceal that you don't eat and to lie to people about not eating by saying, oh, I eat at home, or I'm going to eat when I get home, and things like that. Whereas he's on the school trip now with Nick and they're around each other 24 hours a day and he can no longer conceal it, you know?
Yeah, all those typical phrases you can say to get, I had a big breakfast, or I had a big lunch, suddenly go out the window because they're with you. So I had a big breakfast. No, you didn't. You didn't eat.
Yeah, that's it. And it's that Nick is starting to connect those things together now, and he's starting to understand that Charlie maybe needs a bit of support. Ben appearing in the background in this scene too, behind Nick and Charlie in the breakfast room, again, starting off in focus and then going out of focus, possibly symbolizing how difficult it is for Nick and Charlie to put Ben behind them. Like, it was a pretty traumatic experience that Charlie had with Ben, and he still has to go to school with him. He still has to see him every day. It must be so hard for somebody in that position to really and truly get closure and move on.
Like you say, I think part of the challenge is he's still around him. There is no escape. As an adult, if something happened in a workplace, you could leave your work. Ideally, they would. But if nothing happened, or if you didn't feel comfortable reporting it, you would leave and go work elsewhere. But when you're a kid, you are tied to that school. Yes, he could report it. What would happen? Who knows?
Yeah.
But then it's kind of turning it into this very big thing, which I imagine Charlie wouldn't want to turn it into at that time. I don't imagine he'd be ready for that. So the alternative is shutting up and putting up, which isn't fair.
I know, it's hard. It's so hard. We follow the gang to the Eiffel Tower, where they have to do an exercise. The teachers are so particular in making sure that they learn their French phrases. So they have to do an exercise at the bottom of the Eiffel Tower. This moment made it into our top moments of season two episode, which we released back in August. So if you haven't listened to that, in that episode, we talked about James and Charlie and about Isaac and Harry. In this episode, we're going to pick a couple of different moments just to shake it up a little bit. First of all, we're going to talk about Tara and Darcy. I think this is a really interesting conversation. So they're at the bottom of the Eiffel Tower. They've been split up into groups, and we'll listen to their conversation.
No. Darcy? I want to talk about what happened at the Paris trip meeting.
About Tara's proposal? Yeah, I kind of feel like we should have known it would have been a disaster after that. But I still feel like if they just kiss, they'll figure it out.
Darcy! You know, that's not what I meant. Remember when we were walking into Truro?
No, not really.
You know what? Never mind. Let's just get on with the worksheet.
I feel really sorry for Tara. She's trying so hard to have this conversation with Darcy and really understand what's happening. And she's given Darcy so many opportunities to open up about it. But Darcy's really struggling here too. She's really struggling to talk about what's happening. And we can see how upsetting it is for both of them.
I think that's probably... sorry if you're a young person listening to this podcast, but that's a problem that just continues in adulthood sometimes, is that some people are not very able to talk about their feelings openly. And it is I imagine it's awful being the person that can't talk openly, but it's equally awful to be the person who's constantly trying to drive that conversation, because it takes so much guts and confidence to bring up something awkward or uncomfortable or unpleasant with a partner and then to have them kind of dismiss it. Yeah. And I know she's not like dismissing it and being funny for badness, you know, it's just that she just cannot talk about it, at least right now. But it's so incredibly difficult, and it's just something that happens in relationships regardless of your age. I think it's always difficult to talk about things like that, but seriously, props to her, because she really does try.
Yeah, I think Tara does really well, because she does open up many opportunities throughout this episode, previous episodes, future episodes, to have that conversation. And as we say, Darcy's just not there. She doesn't feel able to share that part of her life, which is understandable. And it was my favorite shocking storyline of season two. And what I mean by shocking is, at least I don't remember it from the books. I don't think it was in the books at all.
I don't think it was.
No, it was a pure addition to this TV show. And I loved how it was kind of handled, because it is something that a lot of young people have to kind of experience. And I think having this to kind of model certain ways to try and have those conversations and eventually break through that and open up to your chosen family is so important.
Definitely. And I guess I agree. I definitely agree that this was a really nice addition to the comics in the way that it was kind of woven into the show. And it starts to build towards the end of season two. And, you know, our guest last week commented that looking back with hindsight, we can really see how big of an impact that this is having with Darcy. And watching it and rewatching it, you rewatch with a real empathy for what she's going through. You know what I mean? It's so hard.
100%.
The camera pans around to Nick and Ben. Ben has decided that Nick is to blame for everything that's happened to him. Let's have a listen.
You happy?
What?
First Charlie, now Imogen. You're the one who told her about me and Charlie, aren't you? It's your mission to, like, mess up my life.
You never cared about either of them. You used Imogen for popularity points, and you didn't actually like Charlie. You just liked having control over him.
What if I said I want Charlie back? I get it, I was a dick back then, but I was dealing with my own shit. Charlie didn't even give me a chance to figure myself out, and then you came along and you stole him from me. Charlie really liked me before you got in his head. At least I was nice enough not to give him a hickey where everyone could see.
It totally amazes me that after everything that's happened, that Ben still sees Charlie as a possession, and that he's so deluded that he thinks that he has a chance of getting back with him. You know what I mean? Like, it just seems totally crazy.
I think it's difficult because it's such a difficult time for everyone at that sort of age, I think.
Yeah.
And especially when you're trying to wrestle with your own sexuality, because I think a lot of people, you know, have their own interesting journeys. I know when I recall mine, you know, I went through the stage of real self-loathing and proper internalized homophobia.
Yeah.
And that doesn't excuse how sometimes somebody can treat somebody else, like Ben, for example. It doesn't excuse his behavior.
Yeah.
But I think from a psychology point of view, it can sometimes make sense a little bit. Like when you look at it from like an objective perspective, you can kind of see why he's lashing out in those ways.
Mm.
As I say, it doesn't excuse it. It doesn't condone it in any way, shape or form. But I think, unfortunately, there may be a lot of people who, when they're younger, going through their kind of own sexual awakening, if you will.
Yeah.
They kind of lash out, or they do act differently to how they would want to.
I know. I feel so much for Ben, and I know he is.
For sure.
I think maybe that's just the older person who works with younger people. And I think, obviously, Ben's behavior towards Nick and Charlie has been abhorrent.
Yeah.
But I also do genuinely believe him that stuff is going on for him. Like, it looks as if Ben is probably also gay, but for whatever reason cannot come out because he's still sort of playing pretend with that other girl whose name escapes me now.
Imogen. How could you forget Imogen's name?
There's so many names, Jimmy. No.
Listen, but, we need to cancel Leo. He forgot who Imogen was.
I know, and I'm also standing up for Ben, which I feel like is a bad thing.
I stood up for Ben in the past too. Like,
good.
The way Ben behaves is totally out of order. You're absolutely right. But he suffers from terrible internalized homophobia. Like, that's a real issue for our community. It's that line, isn't it, between having internalized homophobia and the actions that Ben did take. Like, he assaulted Charlie. It was a sexual assault. We can't, you know, deny that. As much as we empathize with him and we can see maybe why he feels a bit unhappy or he feels that he's struggling, lots of people go through that and they don't sexually assault their partners or their ex-partners, you know?
Exactly. And that's the difference right there, isn't it? Sometimes, you know, when, like, take out sexuality for a minute. Sometimes when we're going through a difficult time, we can become a bit, you know, ratty towards our friends. We can come a bit rude or a bit offensive. But there is still that line of, there's still respect for other people, even when you are going through a tough time and you are being a bit of a dick.
Yeah, for sure.
What Ben does is he does really cross that line, unfortunately. So I can understand,
why I hate him so much.
Yeah. Exactly why he just gets so much hate, even though I do think, you know, hopefully, as we see through the episode, he does kind of come through his own journey a little bit.
He does.
I won't spoil like future conversations for the podcast.
but
hopefully, you know, he does continue to grow and learn from that, and hopefully he doesn't make those mistakes again.
I actually really love how Alice wound up the story arc. I think that's in episode 7. I love how it was all kind of sewn together. That episode's coming up actually with Paula from LGBT Youth Scotland, so she tends to be my go-to guest. Listeners of the show might have realized that any big significant Ben moments, I bring Paula in from LGBT in Scotland, because she's just so good. She's great. So look out for that, listeners. It's going to be coming up in a few weeks. Should we move on to like a happier moment in the show?
Please.
I was going to skip the moment on the Eiffel Tower because not too much happens, but then after watching Nick and Charlie again, I thought it was worth a mention. So let's have a listen to Nick and Charlie on top of the Eiffel Tower.
Okay, this is the most beautiful side.
I need to get a selfie for my mum.
Okay. Smiles.
She's gonna love that.
She is.
Hey, Nick. Is that hickey from you, then?
What if it was? You jealous?
I'm not gay.
Nah, leave him alone, lads. Come on.
Come on. You've got your own problems.
Did Harry just stick up for us?
Come on.
I think he did.
Weird.
Maybe we shouldn't be hanging out right now. More people might think it was you who, you know.
You do know it was me, right?
Yeah, I think I remember you being there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good.
It's such a sweet moment with Nick and Charlie on top of the Eiffel Tower. Nick standing up for them and just seems like he's becoming much more confident in himself and in his sexuality to push back against the rugby lads who outright ask in a jokey way if it was him that gave Charlie the hickey.
I just love that retort. What, you jealous? It's such a good way of kind of shutting it down without being mean. It's not, and what's even better, he didn't actually confirm or deny. He didn't say yes, it was, or no, it wasn't.
That's right.
He just went, what if it was? Are you jealous?
In season 1, one of our guests commented that it was episode 7 where Harry is being a real dick to Charlie at the cinema. I don't know if you remember that episode. And our guest, I have forgotten her name, which is absolutely shocking, said that Knowing that your friend is queer changes how you treat queer people or changes how you feel about queer people. Do you think that's what's going on with Harry, that you can kind of read between the lines now and he's starting to kind of understand that there might be something else going on?
I think our main man, Isaac, is secretly behind the scenes fixing all of the characters' problems, because that little chat that he had with Harry, I have great hopes for Harry being a decent and good person, but I definitely think that little chat with Isaac did something. Like, I've worked with a lot of teenage lads like Harry in my time, and I think the common thing I experience is you'll tell them something, maybe like how Isaac tried to be like, you should be nicer to people, and they'll bat you off and be like, oh, stop being gay, stop being rubbish, and then run off. But it actually does sit there and percolate and work its way down. So by the time they got up to the top of the Eiffel Tower, Harry's a changed man.
That's a good way to plant that seed.
Definitely. I love that moment with Harry and Isaac. I think that's like it's definitely one of the highlights of season two at a stretch, maybe.
Yeah, I've been really enjoying Isaac this season. I'm loving him. But yeah, I definitely think, I think everyone is probably starting to peg on that it is Nick and Charlie. And I think it's probably only Nick's popularity, and also maybe kind of, I would say, like, it is homophobia, the idea of like the stereotype of being gay, that's holding people back from being definite about it. They're like, no, it can't be Nick. He's the captain of the football team. He's proper masculine. Yeah. But I do think that most of them have kind of started to feel it. And I think that that's maybe why they're pulling the pedal off being such absolute dickheads.
I suppose bringing it back to Ben, maybe that's a factor in fueling his like jealousy, because the popular straight guy, suddenly, you know, everybody starts perceiving him as potentially gay, because let's face it, bi isn't a thing, so they'll see him as gay or straight. So if they start seeing him as gay and people accepting that, is he starting to think, well, why isn't that me? Would people accept me? So it could be another factor fueling that kind of vendetta against Nick.
Yeah, that's so true. And did you hear the response from the young person who made the accusation against Nick in the first place? He went, well, I'm not gay. As if bi people don't exist again. Biphobia is everywhere.
But I think my favourite moment from that excerpt you just played was when Nick goes, you do know it was me. I was there.
Oh, I know. It's so good. It's really special. And I think that one of the things that kind of struck Nick was whenever they had their little finger bump and the sparks flew, but then Charlie pulled his hand back. Like, again, you get this kind of look that crosses Nick's face as if he really understands how much and pain and angst it causes Charlie that they can't just be open and honest about their relationship with everybody.
Yeah, and I think I feel bad for dousing a little bit of misery on this beautiful scene, but whenever I watched this at home, honestly, my heart broke a little bit, because Charlie just is constantly apologizing for existing, you know, and Nick so clearly wants to be there and has been so like doing his best to come out and is doing his best to be there. And Charlie is still like, you know, you don't have to be seen with me. Like, you know, people will think it was you. And you can just see that I think Charlie sometimes imagines that he's such a burden on other people, and that it's just like he minimizes himself and his feelings for everybody else, whoever it is. So when I watched that scene, I was like, oh my god, poor Charlie.
I know.
Please, go to therapy.
Oh, we all need to go to therapy.
Can confirm.
As a counsellor, I would love to sit Charlie down and actually start to explore some of these things with him, because I wonder whether he's always kind of felt this way and it's just been exacerbated over the past couple of years with what's happened, or did it kind of stem from when he was outed? Was he quite confident in himself beforehand, puberty hit, which is an awkward time for everybody, and then he gets outed? You know, what happened? I'd love to sit down and psychoanalyze him, but sadly, I don't imagine that'll be happening anytime soon.
Oh, for sure. In the next scene, we skip to Charlie and Tao as they cross the bridge. So they're on their way to the Louvre and they're crossing the bridge. This is one of my favorite moments from the episode. I really love this conversation. Let's take a listen.
You really don't think things are going to work out?
Even if she does like me back, and even if something did happen, I'd still mess it up like I always do with everything.
You don't mess things up. Name one thing you've messed up.
The cinema date, my art coursework, your life multiple times.
How?
Charlie, I'm basically the reason you got outed last year. After you came out to us, I was talking about you with Isaac. Someone overheard, and next thing we know, you're getting bullied every single day. I never wanted to tell you because I didn't want you to hate me.
But you knew that wasn't your fault, don't you? Like, that was clearly an accident. Tao, we've been friends since the first day of year 7.
Hey, I'm Tao.
Charlie.
Cool. Do you like Radiohead?
Yeah.
Me too. Have you seen the Romeo and Juliet movie from the 90s? It's one of my favourite movies, and it's got a Radiohead song on the credits. It makes me cry, like, every time.
I was so shy and scared of everyone, but I immediately thought how cool and funny and kind you were. You were the only person I met that day that I really wanted to be friends with.
Are you guilt-tripping me into being nice about myself?
Even if things don't work out with you and Eric, even if you make mistakes sometimes, you're a good person who deserves love.
Wait, isn't that for you and Nick?
Oh.
People might think you gave me this hickey if you keep this up.
So, I helped to deflect the rumours.
Guys, come on, we need to get to the Louvre.
I really love that moment between Tao and Charlie. It always gives me a lump in my throat. It makes me tear up. It's so cute.
It was so cute seeing, you know, young Charlie and young Tao. It was so cute seeing them together in that way.
Yeah, that was super special. They're both so adorable. Like Tao, as like, what, would they have been like 11 in that clip? 10 or 11, maybe, yeah, a bit older. Opening up about how he cried when he watched Romeo and Juliet. Like, so cute.
I love this moment as well. I think that maybe it's just me. I love Nick and Charlie's relationship. And I think romantic love is a beautiful, wonderful thing. But the older I get, the more important platonic love is to me. And, you know, love can come and go, you know, especially as you're growing up and getting older and moving to unis and separating, yeah, and getting back together. But friendship can very much well be forever. And sometimes the relationships you have with friends are so deep and meaningful that they can sometimes be better than romantic relationships because they can see you at your worst, you know, they can see your best.
That's right.
And I think because there is, I think we're, at least for me, I think that we're much more open and honest with our friends when they do enrich our lives. I think it's a lot easier and a lot more impactful to tell them that you love them. So if you're moved by this moment, tell a mate that you also love them, because that's a lovely thing to do. But, oh, what a beautiful scene. They're so cute.
Definitely, definitely. I'm surprised that Tao hasn't talked to Charlie about how he blames himself for Charlie being outed.
I suppose it's shame, though, isn't it? Because you imagine if you've thought that one of your actions had you could almost think, well, the damage is done, I don't want to lose them as well and leave them more isolated and on their own.
For sure. And it's another sign of how much Tao has grown since season one, where he does have this really deeply embedded fear of loss and losing his friends. We see that come across with in his relationship with Elle and with the rest of the friendship group. So for him to be able to do that now just shows kind of how far he's come. And for Charlie to respond in such a really positive and reinforcing way, to talk about their friendship and how it started and really try to build Tao back up again, is just super sweet. It's really cute.
I think everybody needs to hear the message that you deserve love.
Oh, I know. As humans, we're so hard on ourselves, aren't we? Like, I'm sure that did resonate with a lot of people. It definitely resonated with me for sure.
100%.
We follow the gang to the Louvre and discover that the Mona Lisa is totally rubbish. Like, have you guys been to the Louvre?
No.
Oh,
have you not?
No. It's not worth
it. I have.
No, it is. It is worth it. It's great.
I went on the year 8 trip, which I suppose is what Charlie and Nick are mimicking in Heartstopper. I literally did this trip with my school in year 8, so a few years younger than they were. And I remember queuing for ages to get to the Mona Lisa. And I'm sorry to any Mona Lisa fans, but it was not half as amazing as I expected it to be in person.
Yeah, for sure. I took the kids to Paris last year and we had an amazing trip. Like, we had a great trip. And I laughed so much at this moment because Darcy reacted exactly the same way as my 13-year-old reacted. She was like, oh my God, I can't believe that we made it to see this. It's tiny. You know, it was so funny. But the Paris is a great city. I always talk Paris down, but it's a great city. The Louvre's great. You should definitely go. And this is a really special moment. I really loved watching Tao and Elle in these scenes as they explore the museum. Like, Tao spends just as much time watching Elle as he does looking at the art on the walls. And as the group explores, there's this really touching moment between Elle and Nick as they look up at some ceiling art. Let's have a listen to their conversation.
I don't think I really understand any of the art, but it's nice to look at.
You don't always need to understand it to enjoy it.
That's why it feels kind of romantic.
Yeah.
I guess that's true of real life as well.
What is?
Like, you don't have to understand your feelings completely to know that you like something. You don't have to always have figured everything out. You can just feel.
That's another one of those moments that I really love in this episode. We get like these little pockets of like great life advice like all the time from characters like Charlie earlier on, Nick now, saying that you don't need to understand your feelings completely. You can just feel. Like, it's slightly abbreviated, but it feels like such important advice for everybody that you don't have to understand everything. You can just feel.
Yeah, I think it's such a philosophical message, but one that is so relevant for everyone. Everyone can learn from that. A lot of counselling, to be fair, is trying to come to grips with your feelings and not necessarily being able to understand them, but sometimes just being able to tolerate them, let them pass, experience them while you've got them. You don't have to have it all figured out to make a move.
Definitely, definitely. I really love that this is the little shove that Elle needs as well. Like, after this conversation with Nick, she looks around and takes Tao by the hand and they run off through the Louvre together. Like, it's really good. Like, this was like the few words that she needed just to kind of give her that little push. And then we get this great montage of them like exploring together and laughing and enjoying each other's company.
How nice. How lovely. To have a date in the Louvre. Sitting at home in South Belfast in my flat watching, I was like, this is not fair. I have not had a date at the Louvre, but lovely. It's gorgeous.
Maybe soon, Leo. You never know.
While Tao and Elle are off exploring, Darcy and Tara have a slightly less romantic moment. Tara takes a picture or is taking pictures with Darcy's phone when her mum texts. Let's have a listen.
Just like her, isn't it?
Do we not have the same physique? The same drama?
Do the pose and then I'll see.
Okay,
like,
hang on.
Oh, your mum texts you?
Wow, okay. It's nothing.
Let's take a photo with this one.
How come I've never even met your parents?
I don't know. Come on.
Why do you always do that? Why do you always avoid the issue? Sometimes I feel like you're hiding stuff from me.
I'm not.
I've never met your parents. I've never been to your house, and you didn't even want to say I love you back.
It was just a casual I love you. You said you didn't mean it like that.
But you know I did. You know I do.
The text from Darcy's mum triggers Darcy's reaction. It's the first time that we get this direct connection being made between what's going on with Tara and Darcy and Darcy's life at home with her mum. She grabs the phone out of Tara's hand and Tara confronts her about hiding things from her, and she starts to connect the dots between everything that's been going on and realizes that she hasn't met her mum, that she hasn't been to Darcy's house. It's a really tough moment.
It's incredibly tough. And I think, unfortunately, it may mimic many LGBTQ plus people's experiences if they are out to the parents, or if they are kind of expressing different, you know, gender norms or different preferences. If their parents aren't on board, they can instantly start to push back. And then the child or the young person has that choice whether to try and push on and be their authentic self, or whether they try and hide it and conform to what, you know, their parents and family's expectations are. So I think it's just, unfortunately, a perfect example of how life can be for some people during that time.
It must be really hard, because to be in that position where you almost have to make a choice of whether living an authentic life and being rejected, or just living with that fear of rejection and secrecy, is, it must just be so horrible.
And I really feel for Darcy as well, because it kind of makes sense now why she's not wanting to engage in this conversation. Because I know for a lot of people, especially if you have, whether you perceive your family are homophobic or they actually are homophobic, if you are in a really loving, sweet relationship like the two of them are, it's kind of like your little island, your little paradise, your little moment to get away from it all. And especially, yes, I imagine being out of the house and away for them for several days at a time, like that's the last thing they want to do in the Louvre after they've absolutely trashed the Mona Lisa, is to talk about how difficult it is at home. And, you know, you can only imagine, especially as a young person, you would feel guilty that your partner cannot be a part of your life in the same way that you're part of theirs, because yeah, of how, and you feel like, even though it's absolutely no one's fault if you have homophobic family, you can't help but feel like guilty and responsible for that. So, you know, you probably doesn't want Tara to be thinking less of her, or even, I mean, maybe this is just me as a stubborn person, but being pitied, I do not like that. So Darcy seems like someone who really likes to be the life of the party and to be fun and exuberant. So I imagine the last thing she wants is to get pity. You know, for her, it's just every day. You know, she'd rather just forge on with what life she can do outside of the house. But oh, poor Darcy.
I know, it's really hard. It is. It's tough. In the moments that follow, Charlie starts to feel really disorientated and he faints, calling out to Nick, who catches him as he falls. For fans, this is a really difficult moment.
It was very hard to watch. I think, again, I read the comics so far back now from watching it, I can't remember what exactly was in it and not, but regardless of whether it was in the comics or not, that specific scene, I was still shocked when it happened. I don't think, even if you knew it was coming, even rewatching it, it's still a shock to see something like that so dramatic happen so quickly. 1 minute he's fine and he seems a bit off and a bit disorientated, perhaps in the next minute he faints. Yeah,
that's it. And it's the first time now that we get the physical manifestations of his, of symptoms that are related to his disordered eating.
What's scary is, it as you say, you know, it's the first time that it physically manifests, and it kind of, it opens Pandora's box. It's now real. He can't deny it. He can't hide it. He's very clearly fainted in public with loads of people around. People are now aware that something is wrong.
Yeah, really tough. We cut to Tao and Elle and finally catch the longest awaited scene of the entire season. They find a quiet corner overlooking the Louvre Pyramid. Let's have a listen to their conversation.
It's so beautiful here. It makes me want to draw.
You should. I love watching you draw. The building is just so cinematic. They should make more movies in the Louvre. I can only think of the Da Vinci Code, and you would literally have to tie me to a chair if you wanted me to watch that actual monstrosity again.
Oh my God.
Elle.
I'm so sorry. Let's just forget that happened.
Elle.
You can force him to love you. He can't expect you to be alright with all the bullshit he gives you. You wake up drenched in
mosquito. I don't know how to do this.
Me neither.
Such a sweet moment as Tal vents by the Da Vinci Code of all things. Elle leans in for a kiss. We've been waiting for this moment for such a long time.
Yeah, it's such a great moment in this episode because it's nice to finally see them take a positive step forward. Both in real life and in fiction, I feel we often witness or experience these, like, will they, won't they relationships. It's so satisfying when it finally happens. They finally wake up and realize that the audience has been screaming about all along.
I think that's the thing of when you are friends first, particularly in a relationship, yeah. If you are really close friends, you can really overthink dating. Like, dating and friendship are actually very similar. I think, at least I'm still trying to figure it out, but I think dating just involves kissing each other. I mean, a good friend and a good partner are kind of the same thing. So they really get in their heads about it. It was almost... I could only imagine being Tao and Ellie's friend and listening to either of them every single week be like, oh, she doesn't like me. Oh, he's not for me. And you just going, girl, please, the two of you are obviously so good together. Just make it work. But yeah, I think that's definitely Nick's speech about, like, just feeling your feelings and going with what's right. And I think... you can get so focused on doing something perfectly or, you know, talking about how things are going to go. And that's a good, communication is always a good thing to do. But, like, when it comes to romance, sometimes the heat of the moment is the best way to go forward because all those conversations can happen afterward when you've assured that the spark is there and it's something that you enjoy. So I'm glad that they finally figured it out.
Oh, definitely, definitely. It was really good. And I love how vulnerable they both were in this moment too. Like, Elle kisses Tao and immediately apologizes for it. And then he tells her that he doesn't really know what he's doing. And it's just a really lovely, vulnerable moment for both of them where they just kind of come together as friends first and share this moment. You know, it was such a joy to watch with the butterflies, and it all kind of tied in so well with the butterflies and Tao's shirt and all these little details. It was great. It was really satisfying. This was one of your picks, Tim. You picked this as your top moment.
Yeah, as I said, it was mainly because throughout the entire season one and season two so far, it has just been vamping up to this moment. It's the will they, won't they? What's going to happen? Are they ever going to take that step and finally accept that they like each other and, you know, begin that kind of romance? And it's just so nice that they finally, when, you know, took that time to be vulnerable together and hopefully, you know, I mean, we know the rest of season two anyway, but hopefully into the future as well, it continues that way.
Yeah, definitely. It's great to watch. It really is. We cut from this moment to another romantic teaser between the two teachers. So we join Mr. Furke and Mr. Ajay in one of the galleries at the Louvre. It's this really sweet moment where Mr. Ajay thinks that Mr. Furke looks like a man in one of the paintings. Let's listen to their conversation.
That is uncanny.
I don't see it.
Stand in front of it, I'll show you. Go on, and do the pose as well.
I don't do poses.
Yes, you do. Go on. Another facial expression.
How adorable are these guys? It's so nice to see this type of queer experience represented in the show. This was very validating, although I can't claim to be the same age as these two, but it's very validating to see, like, a bit of romance between a couple of older characters.
I love the fact that they included this storyline in the show.
Yeah,
I'm sure there are many people who, for whatever reason, were unable to come out or begin exploring their sexuality until later on in life. I know when, because When season two came out, I'd booked the day off and we binged, me and a few friends sat and binged all of season one and all of season two. It was great. Highly recommend. And I remember one of my friends who has sat there has kind of begun their own journey, kind of exploring the sexuality, and they're, you know, mid 30s. And that literally made them cry. just seeing those moments where they were like, oh my god, like, that's me, that they could identify with those characters. It's like they never got the chance growing up, but you know, everybody has their own reasons, but it was so nice to see it included.
I am a Mr. Farouk diehard. I think he is fabulous. I would watch a spin-off show of him just living his everyday life. And I think my favorite thing about Mr. Farouk as well, especially Mr. Ajay, is that you know, adults, certainly there is stuff around adult gay or bisexual men having relationships and falling in love, although quite frequently those will be I suppose they'll be more adult, you know, there will be more darker themes, more difficulties, maybe more sexual overtones, which is great, which is fine, which I love. But there was something really lovely about having just like being a fly on the wall of like a really cute sort of completely nondescript interaction between these lovely two gay men. It's so cute. I'm obsessed. They're so lovely.
For sure.
I think it's just the innocence of it all. You just see that kind of, those budding feelings starting to appear. It's just so nice.
It's so sweet. Like, you can, like, there's so much chemistry just in those few seconds. Like, it really is. It's great. Sadly, the moment is interrupted by Isaac and Imogen. Remember Imogen, that poor girl that you forgot, Leo?
How can you forget Imogen? She's one of the best characters.
It's so bad because that's her whole thing. That's her whole thing, is that people aren't friends with her, and I forgot her friggin' name. I'm awful.
I'd be friends with her. Just saying, I would be her friend.
Oh, I will 100%. We'll forgive you. Maybe we'll let you know at the end. So sadly, the moment's interrupted by Isaac and Imogen, who tell them that Charlie has fainted. Mr. Ajay and Mr. Farouk rush to see Charlie. And once they make sure that he isn't in immediate danger, they get him settled in the cafe where Nick offers Charlie some support. Let's listen.
Charlie, I've noticed you don't really eat a lot. Generally. Or, I don't know, it kind of feels like it's gotten worse lately. Like, I feel like you eat less than you used to.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
Hey, no. You have nothing to be sorry about. I want to understand.
I know I don't eat like normal people. Some days I'm fine, but other days I feel like I need to control it. I used to do it a lot last year, and everything at school was really bad. Sometimes it feels like the only thing I can control in my life. That makes zero sense. You can just forget this.
It does make sense. Okay, maybe I don't totally get it, but I still want to know if you're feeling like that. If you're having a bad day, or if there's anything that I can do to make things less stressful, cheering you up, but I'm your boyfriend, Charlie. And I really care about you.
I really respect how brave Nick is for bringing this up with Charlie and for being so matter of fact about it. Like, that would be really hard to do.
He did so well. The way he handled it just so maturely and so calmly and empathetically, especially, you know, he's just fainted into you. And 2 moments later, you know, you're sitting talking very understandingly and just wanting to kind of encourage him to open up about it instead of getting frustrated, which some people might, especially when they don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, God, Nick smashed that conversation like full-grown adults probably couldn't do that as calmly and as kindly as he did. And I think what I really loved about how he started that conversation was it wasn't so much of a question, but it gave him so many places to go from and said, I noticed you don't eat a lot, you know, and that's not, there was no like, you don't eat enough, you know, like there's no kind of like, there's no way that that could be misconstrued as a wink, a finger waggler, like someone pointing the blame at him. It's just, I notice you don't eat a lot, which is, it's just such a clever way to put it. And I think what I really loved is him, you know, telling him that he had nothing to apologize for, that he just cared and that he was his boyfriend and he wanted to know if he needed help. I mean, just God, Nick is great. Nick is awesome.
He is. Later on in the books, we see that Charlie gets diagnosed with anorexia, and he talks here about feeling like he needs to control his eating, that sometimes he feels like that it's the only thing that he can control.
Many people with anorexia are seeking control by restricting their eating, but the reasons behind this can vary greatly depending on, you know, their own individual experiences.
Yeah.
I think back over some clients I've worked with, and for many who have presented with anorexia, one of the main factors fueling it is that need for that control. I remember one client who, just suffering through some childhood trauma, found that restricting their eating allowed them to feel in more in control. It can sound odd to people who have never experienced it or have never known anybody who has experienced it. I remember there's a quote from Terminator, of all places, which I use quite a lot in my counseling. I feel it encapsulates many behaviors behind a lot of mental health conditions. And the quote is, in an insane world, it was the sadist choice. And I think it just highlights that, you know, when you're looking at it from one perspective, where you've not been through that experience or not, you know, walked in their shoes, it can seem a very odd behavior. It can seem a very strange way to react. But actually, when you flip it from their perspective, where everything is upside down, they're just trying to find the best way to get through it.
Oh, that's so insightful. Do you think the lack of control that Charlie talks about is maybe linked to his past and being outed at school? I know it's hard to say because we're quite limited in what we know about Charlie's past, but it does seem like that's maybe implied.
I mean, I definitely think so. I work with all kinds of LGBTQI plus people, from like young to old, and the one common denominator for everybody is the trauma of being a queer or trans person in secondary or grammar school. None of us, I hope it's getting different now, but none of us escape that without some scarring. We are raised so much from the discussion from parents and adults during that time of our life that we have no one solidifying that we have value, we have purpose, we are here and we deserve love, like lovely Charlie said earlier. But on top of that, the only kind of discussion that you're getting about that is often like bullying, you know, it's people bullying. And whether you're the direct target of that bullying or not, it leaves a mark. You know, if the only time you hear about LGBT people is when someone's slagging someone else off, when they're trying to tease them, when they're making fun of how someone dresses, like, it's impossible, I think, as a queer and trans person to leave high school without having that experience of feeling completely invisible and yet totally in view of everybody else. And I can imagine, especially for Charlie, as someone who was outed and someone who was known to be gay before he was ready to come out with it, how it must constantly feel like other people are watching him and how other people are looking at him and how other people are perceiving him. And he can't do anything about that. You know, the Pandora's box has already been opened. He can't control what people says. He can't control. The only thing he can control is his own behavior. And he does that by what he ate. And I think especially if for a lot of people, like I would consider like self-harm and eating disorders are really similar, because it is about control. So for some people, the pain of self-harm, the pain of having an empty stomach, that can be almost relaxing. It can be like, it can be relieving, because I think for some people, when emotional pain is so overwhelming that you can barely function, that you can barely feel it, doing something like skipping a few meals or hurting yourself, it gives you like a physical outlet for that really difficult emotional pain that you can't even really talk about or understand yourself.
When it comes to self-harm and eating disorders, as you were saying, Leo, with like that pain, that immense, intense pain, one thing that I remember learning a long time ago, and it's always stuck with me, is, you know, listeners listening right now, I'm sure all of us at some point have stubbed our toe, whether it's our big toe or pinky toe, on something. And for those few seconds of pain, everything else in the world disappeared. So, you know, whatever stress you were carrying, whatever worries, vanished. And for some people, that can be, you know, those few seconds, those few moments of relief from that can be bliss. You know, and as Leo touched on, you know, there's a million and one different reasons why people, you know, self-harm. There's a million different reasons why people can develop an eating disorder. You know, it's as varied as our fingerprints pretty much at this point. But there are some common themes. And I think it's so interesting, Heartstopper. I think it's so important that Heartstopper, where it already had this big platform, and I know it was in the comics, but are using it to kind of highlight some of these concerns for people. Because I remember when I was in school, this wasn't talked about. LGBT, as Leo said, was predominantly mocking and taunting. Eating disorders, it may have come up in one class once, but it wasn't ever spoken about. Self-harm, I remember seeing a few people who had scars, but it was never kind of talked about. It was this shrouded in mystery. And all that does is perpetuate shame. And I think talking to one of my friends who has kids, her kids are like 11, 12, 13 sort of age, their school experience seems to be a lot more positive and informative than mine did. The sex ed, at least in Leicestershire, because I can only speak for what I know, but Leicestershire seems to be a lot more inclusive of LGBTQ plus concerns. There's a lot more in there with how things work and how relationships, healthy relationships, should look like, regardless of gender, regardless of sexuality. So it, from my perspective, from what I'm hearing, it does sound like things are slowly starting to change for the positive.
Yeah,
but I think there's still a long way to go.
One of the things that got me in about the scene, and it comes back to us talking about how subtly Charlie's disordered eating was introduced in season one through his absence at meal times and things like that, was whenever Nick first says to Charlie about how he's noticed that he doesn't eat very much, Charlie instinctively starts to pull at his jumper at the, like, at his elbow, on his forearm. And I just wonder whether that's them starting to weave Charlie's self-harm story arc into the narrative of what's happening at the moment. And it made me wonder whether this was maybe linked to his past experiences of self-harm, or maybe it's an indication that he has already experienced a self-harm relapse.
Well, I was thinking the whole time I was watching this is that they said it was incredibly hot, that you could possibly get heat stroke, and he was still wearing sleeves. So my assumption was that he probably has either had a relapse or still has some kind of scarring. What I thought of that scene immediately when he, because it was barely a blink of an eye, that scene where he starts pulling in the jumper. And I thought to myself, that looks like when people pinch themselves, you know, like it's a, that's a really kind of subtle way of self-harming quickly, you know, like it, obviously it leaves no marks and, you know, all self-harm, regardless of what it is still self-harm, but just that instant kind of pinch of, like, you know, I almost, and I think about self-harm, I think a lot of it has to do with guilt and burdening people with your problems, and that's why you kind of have to take it out on yourself. And when Nick is coming to him completely lovingly about his concerns about him not eating, his Charlie's immediate response is to, I've upset my boyfriend, I've worried my boyfriend, I'm a bad person, you know, pinch, you know, like, that was what my knee-jerk reaction was to that scene.
Definitely. And I think seeing, like you said, Leo, it was Paris, it was hot. Almost all the other characters are wearing t-shirts or something short-sleeved. And then there's Charlie, jumpers and long sleeves. So it just suggests that there's either some sort of relapse or some scarring that he doesn't want anybody else to see.
The other thing that we touched on a bit earlier was how supportive Nick comes across, you know, whenever he has this conversation. But it does feel like Charlie needs a bit more help than he can offer.
Yeah, I think So far, Nick has done a fantastic job supporting Charlie. He's listened to him. He's really tried to understand his struggles. And especially when somebody's not experienced something like that, it can be really difficult to understand why somebody is behaving that way. Or, you know, we can get frustrated and unintentionally take out our frustrations on the person we want to help. So from that perspective, I would encourage Nick to continue exactly what he's doing. But I think he does need to be careful because for Nick's own well-being, he needs to make sure that he's not solely trying to support Charlie, because I don't know anybody can be the sole person in charge of somebody else's well-being. You know, I remember being that age and feeling as though I could support all my friends with all their concerns. And sometimes I could, but sometimes you do need to seek, you know, professional help or adult help. So if Charlie begins struggling more or his condition worsens, I'd say to Nick, then it's time to get the appropriate adults and professionals in so they can intervene and support him.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think a lot of if young people are listening and they're kind of, I think a lot of people are worried about telling an adult because that can sometimes spin off actions that maybe are outside of your control. Like if you tell Charlie's parents, then Charlie's parents might be upset. If you tell a teacher, what does that do? But don't forget there are lots of places where you can get anonymous help and support as well. Like everyone knows how to use Google these days, like you know, Google eating disorders charities in your area. Many places will have helplines or emails, or there's a lot, like Rainbow Project generally will offer counseling to young people, even if there's not a parent involved, but at least one supportive adult. And considering how well Nick gets, Charlie gets on with his teacher, I would definitely be considering talking to his teacher, because those two seem to have a real good understanding of each other. But definitely, just like Tim said, this stuff is hard to deal with, even when you are a fully qualified, trained professional. Like therapists who deal with this stuff also go to therapy to look after themselves. So if you're like 16, 17, as much as you must be the loving best friend in the world, you need to look after you too. And sometimes that means talking to somebody else to get like better advice and better support, because there's only so much you can do.
Well, the thing is with the professionals, they're often teams, especially when it comes to eating disorders. You don't tend to have just one person. You have a whole team of people responsible for trying to intervene and support that person. So it's so unrealistic to expect one person to be able to do the job of a team of professionals. And that's not me trying to put down any one individual. You know, with the best will in the world, we can do our best to try and support the people we care about, but sometimes they do need that more, you know, professional support. And there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes it's exactly what they need to get back on track.
Very good. That's really insightful. What might a treatment plan look like for Charlie from like your perspective as a counselor, if I can lean on your perspective? I know it isn't your area of expertise.
That's fine. I think it all depends on the service he accesses, you know, his age, weight, and the risk he poses to himself. So if anyone listening is struggling with anorexia or knows somebody who is, I would advise them to see their local GP and they can advise which route would be best. There are many effective psychological treatments out there. And again, it depends on what is available in your local area and what style of therapy or treatment would be most effective for your needs. But with Charlie's age, if he is under BMI, so that's body mass index for people who aren't aware, then he would likely end up in an inpatient setting on a refeeding program. And refeeding programs focuses on his physical health. So a lot of these services tend to focus on the physical health first, just because this poses the most risk. Once his weight is back in what is considered a healthy range, then he could access psychological support, which would then focus on stabilizing his eating behaviors and begin exploring what is fueling his anorexia.
Oh, that's so interesting. Thanks so much for bringing that. That's really insightful. It really is great. Should we talk about something a bit happier? Should we move on to our next moment? We stick with Nick and Charlie for our next moment. Nick's dad finally returns his call. Let's have a listen.
Ça va? J'ai pu le faire? Ok. À bientôt.
Bye. Okay. Sorry about that. He said, what? You speak French? Like, fluently? Sort of. My dad's French, and he basically only speaks to me in French, so... Anyway, he lives in Paris, so I've been trying to... Wait, do you like the fact that I speak French?
It's fine. It's cool.
Charlie! Mon amour.
Oh my God, you're so cringe.
You actually don't look like you're cringing. You look like you're blushing.
I quite am a lot, not.
Actually. Oh yeah, sure.
Leave me alone, you dick.
Oh. No. No. Pas de ça ici.
Run.
Such a sweet moment. Much needed after how intense the last scene was. Imagine being shouted at by a guard in the Louvre. Like,
just as you do. You know, you go to the Louvre, you get yelled at. It's all part of a typical day in Paris.
This was another moment that you picked, Tim.
Yeah, I it's so funny because I just laughed so hard.
Yeah.
Because it's just the, you know, you speak French. Do you find it, can't remember exactly what he says, but do you find it attractive that I speak French? And he's like, no. And it, oh, very obviously he does. And it's just so funny when he goes, mon amour. I just find it so funny.
It is hilarious.
It's such a light contrast to, as you say, the dark scene, you know, moments before. It was just such a nice and return to the heart-stopper bubbliness we all love and adore.
My thing is, does Nick not realize what an absolute stone-cold teenage dream he is? Like, he's such a heartthrob. Like, I cannot cope with him. He's like, oh, yeah, I speak a little bit of French. And it drives me insane that he is not aware of the effect that he is having on every single character. Because it's not just Charlie who loves him talking French. Every single character who's seen Nick talk French has been like, you speak French? But I suppose for him it's quite double-edged sword, because yes, he speaks French, but only because his dad will only talk to him in French.
That's true.
Sorry, I keep coming in your sweet moments and swooping in with some horribly cutting insight. But so cute, so lovely.
It was great. We finish up the show with Nick and Charlie having a chat about his dad. Charlie asks a couple of probing questions about Nick's dad and their relationship. Let's have a listen to this final scene.
My dad wants to meet up, like, today.
You ever mentioned your dad before?
I mean, he's not really a big part of my life anymore since he lives here, and he's not the most reliable. He's still my dad, so... I had this idea that I might introduce you to him.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's just hard to get in touch with him when he never answers my texts.
How about we promise to tell each other when we've got stuff going on?
Deal.
When are you actually meeting up with him? And how?
I said I'd meet him in a cafe in 20 minutes. You'll never be the same.
Such a great scene. I really love that scene at the end where they're just so supportive of each other, that Charlie offers Nick to be that person that Nick can lean on whenever he feels like this about his dad. It makes this whole thing between Nick and his dad so bittersweet, because he's just so excited to see his dad. And one of the reasons why is that he wants to introduce Charlie as his boyfriend. Like, this is like a really big moment. He wants to come out to his dad, and his dad has like been all wishy-washy the whole time.
It's like watching a car wreck happen, because I'm sitting there thinking there is like every signal in the world said that this is not going to work. His dad's not going to be interested. And I just wish for once things would go as Nick wants them to go. I think Nick is maybe very much a glass half full kind of guy. He always seems to see the best in people, and which I suppose does make it quite sad that despite how his dad has kind of ignored him the whole trip, and yet he still thinks that this is going to be the moment to be able to introduce Charlie. And I just wish it would work for him, but it's just going to the hardest level.
Definitely. And it's that thing about acceptance. All queer people want is acceptance. You know what I mean? Especially from the people that we're closest to, like our family and friends and everything else. And it's just, it's hard. It's hard to watch somebody go through this.
Am I the only one who was really shocked by them literally skipping the Louvre and going and getting on like a metro train, whatever it's called, underground thing?
Yeah.
And I just sat there like, I would never have done that at their age, especially in a foreign country. I would have not. I was too good a kid at school. I would have never dared. And they
would be in so much trouble. Like, seriously, they would be in so much trouble. There are times in all TV shows where you have to suspend disbelief, and Heartstopper is no different. There are moments where you just have to suspend disbelief.
Yeah, definitely.
Listen, though, I feel like if I was going to let a kid run off in Paris, it would probably be Nick. He seems like, out of all the school children, he's the most head on his shoulders, knows how to speak French. You know, he's a good boy, so I think he's all right. But what are Mr. Farouk and Ajay doing? Like, really?
I know.
Noodling at the Louvre?
For sure, for sure. Leo and Tim, thank you so much for coming on and sharing in this experience where we talk about episode 5. It has been fantastic, fantastic. What do you think are the highlights of season 2 for you both?
I'm very boring, but it's going to be Mr. Farouk. Literally any scene that he's in is my favorite scene of all time. He brings me back to high school. I think he's beautiful and gorgeous and funny. And I haven't seen the last 2 episodes, but I hope all things go well for him. And that they do give him a spin-off show that's just for me.
Leo, you must be the only Heartstopper fan in the whole world that hasn't watched the whole of season 2. Like, honestly, I must have watched it like at least 7 or 8 times already, if not more.
I like to savor things. I like to savor. and I don't, if, unlike you, Tim, none of my friends want to watch Heartstopper with me. They all think it's, they're all too serious. So I have to do it by the dark of night when no one's about.
Leo, next time we can stream together.
Absolutely.
We'll do like a live watch. That's such a good idea. We should do a live watch.
I think for me, season 2 highlights were, again, like Leo, a bit boring in some ways, but I suppose I love seeing Nick and Charlie progress. I love seeing how they kind of flourished. And I love the development with so many of the characters. Like, I love seeing how Isaac kind of, you know, grew. I love seeing the Tara and Darcy stuff, especially Darcy's backstory. It was just so, all of it was just so vibrant and interesting. And I just love every moment. And why is season 3 not already out? Just saying.
Oh, I know. They've started to make it. It's great. We get like little photos that fans are taking on locations. So good.
I've seen.
What are your hopes and dreams for season 3?
As someone who struggled with mental health issues as a young person and as an adult, I am really very excited to see how they handle Charlie's self-harm storyline. Because when I was growing up, and I'm sure it's still pretty similar today, but when I was growing up, self-harm storylines were somebody self-harmed, they went to hospital, like the most dramatic version of a hospital possible, and then immediately they were better forever, you know, never got brought up again. So I'm really curious to see how they, I have really high hopes on seeing how they show Nick, Charlie's mental health difficulties.
Yeah.
But like, not have that be like a close and shut book of like, oh, well, that's the storyline done with. Like, I hope it is something that kind of follows through. And obviously I'm just hoping for more Mr. Farouk, really.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to see what Isaac reads next. I'm concerned that the man needs another hobby, because that's a lot of books. I love reading too, but
The best Isaac story, or the best Isaac episodes are yet to come for you, Leo. Just wait.
I'm gonna do it right after this, I'm telling you.
You should. You really should.
I've been judged horribly this whole show. First, I couldn't remember Imogen's name. Now that it comes out, I haven't seen 2 episodes, and I'm dead to you. Can't just, even take it.
I'm just going to mute your microphone for the whole episode.
Yeah. And I think for me, season three, I really can't wait to continue to see how Nick and Charlie progress. I mean, I know there's the Nick and Charlie book, but I've not read that yet. So that is one on my list. We've got it. I just haven't read it. So, but I can't wait to see how their relationship continues to kind of grow. And I really hope there's more justice for Imogen in season three. I love Imogen. I've got such a soft spot for her. And the fact in season two, she went through the Ben stuff as well. It seems like Ben gets everywhere. But I'm so pleased she's through that phase now. And hopefully she can find someone nice.
Well, apparently the whole Ben and Imogen relationship thing was their idea. Like, they went to Alice with that suggestion and she wrote it into the show, which is a really interesting little piece that I got from an article I read somewhere. Like, they talked about it. Do you remember whenever they were standing outside waiting for Nick to come out after playing rugby? Like, they were there for the whole day, like, filming those shots, and they talked about it and they took it to Alice and it was written in, which is actually a really lovely little detail, you know?
That's absolutely great.
Yeah.
I was going to say, for your listeners, I just want to point out, I did read the Nick and Charlie book, so technically I am a bigger fan than Tim. So no cancelling just as yet. Justice for Leo, that's all I'm saying.
What happened in the last two episodes? What can you remember?
I don't know. I don't know yet. I'm holding on to it with whimsy I have left, dear Tim, but I'll get
Come on, boys. Behave.
Just have a wrestle match next time for best Heartstopper fan.
That's it. Top fan position.
Yeah.
Let me set up the YouTube channel first so we can all watch instead of just listen. Leo and Tim, thanks so much again for coming on and supporting the show. The show absolutely would not exist without partners like the Rainbow Project and people like you, Tim. I'm really, really grateful that you've given up your time to come on and talk about Heartstopper and help us understand a little bit of what's going on and what that might be like for people in the real world. And thank you too, listeners, for tuning in. And if you're listening now, it means you made it right to the end, so you get extra brownie points. Don't forget to look down at your phone right now, hit that subscribe button. It makes such a huge difference. Also hit our Instagram page, give us a follow. We'd really appreciate it at Proper Fallen Gay Podcast. And as always, feel free to drop us a line. Tell me about all the mistakes that I've made, and also tell me about how much you love Heartstopper. I would really, really love to hear from you. Thanks so much again. All there is left for us to do, Leo and Tim, is to say goodbye.
Bye.
Today's show is produced by Shut Up World with me, Jamie, and special guests Leo from The Rainbow Project and Tim from Tandem Counselling. Copywritten material within this episode is made available to provide criticism, comment, or review, and to advance the understanding of issues which impact the queer community. For more information, please see our Fair Use and Fair Dealing statement at www.properfullongaypodcast.com.